Chapter 6. Suppose all the nations of the earth to send fitting ambassadors to represent them at Wapping or Portsmouth Point, with each under its own national signboard and language, its appropriate house of call, and your imagination may figure the main street of Gibraltar, almost the only part of the town, I believe, which boasts of the name of street at all, the remaining house rows being modestly called lanes, such as Bomb Lane, Battery Lane, Fusee Lane, and so on. In Main Street the Jews predominate, the Moors abound, and from the Ollie Sailor, or the Brave Horse Marine, where the people of our nation are drinking British beer and gin, you hear choruses of Ariel and her Lass I Left Behind Me, while through the flaring lattices of the Spanish ventas come the clatter of castanets, and the jingle and moan of Spanish guitars and ditties. It is a curious sight at evening, this thronged street, with the people, in 100 different costumes, bustling to and fro under the coarse flare of the lamps, swarthy Moors, in white or crimson robes, dark Spanish smugglers in tufted hats, with gay silk handkerchiefs round their heads, fuddled seamen from men of war, or merchantmen, porters, Galician, or Genese, and at every few minutes interval, little squads of soldiers tramping to relieve guard at some one of the innumerable posts in the town. Some of our party went to a Spanish venta as a more convenient or romantic place of residence than an English house. Others made choice of the clubhouse in Commercial Square, of which I formed an agreeable picture in my imagination, rather, perhaps, resembling the Junior United Service Club in Charles Street, by which every Londoner has passed ere this with respectful pleasure, catching glimpses of magnificent blazing candelabras, under which sit neat half-pay officers, drinking half pints of port. The clubhouse of Gibraltar is not, however, of the Charles Street sort. It may have been cheerful once, and there are yet relics of splendor about it. When officers wore pigtails, and in the time of Governor O'Hara, it may have been a handsome place, but it is moldy and decrepit now. And though His Excellency, Mr. Bulwer, was living there, and made no complaints that I heard of, other less distinguished persons thought they had reason to grumble. Indeed, what is traveling made of? At least half its pleasures and incidents come out of inns, and of them the tourist can speak with much more truth and vivacity than of historical recollections compiled out of histories, or filched out of handbooks. But to speak of the best inn in a place needs no apology. That, at least, is useful information. As every person intending to visit Gibraltar cannot have seen the flea-bitten countenances of our companions, who fled from their Spanish venta to take refuge at the club the morning after our arrival, they may surely be thankful for being directed to the best house of accommodation in one of the most unromantic, uncomfortable, and prosaic of towns. If one had a right to break the sacred confidence of the mahogany, I could entertain you with many queer stories of Gibraltar life, gathered from the lips of the gentlemen who enjoyed themselves round the dingy tablecloth of the clubhouse coffee room, richly decorated with cold gravy and spilt beer. I heard there the very names of the gentlemen who wrote the famous letters from the war spite regarding the French proceedings at Mogador, and met several refugee Jews from that place, who said that they were much more afraid of the Kabyles without the city than of the guns of the French squadron, of which they seemed to make rather light. I heard the last odds on the ensuing match between Captain Smith's B.G. Bolter and Captain Brown C.H. C. Roarer. How the gunroom of Her Majesty's ship Purgatory had obbed a tradesman of the town, and of the row in consequence. I heard capital stories of the way in which Wilkins had escaped the guard, and Thompson had been locked up among the mosquitoes for being out after 10 without the lantern. I heard how the governor was an old, but to say what, would be breaking a confidence. Only this may be divulged, that the epithet was exceedingly complimentary to Sir Robert Wilson. All the while these conversations were going on, a strange scene of noise and bustle was passing in the marketplace, in front of the window, where Moors, Jews, Spaniards, soldiers were thronging in the sun, and a ragged fat fellow, mounted on a tobacco barrel, with his hat cocked on his ear, was holding an auction, and roaring with an energy and impudence that would have done credit to Covent Garden. The Moorish castle is the only building about the rock which has an air at all picturesque or romantic. There is a plain Roman Catholic cathedral, a hideous new Protestant church of the cigar divan architecture, and a courthouse with a portico which is said to be an imitation of the Parthenon. The ancient religions houses of the Spanish town are gone, or turned into military residences, and damasked, so that you would never know their former pious destination. You walk through narrow whitewashed lanes, bearing such martial names as are before mentioned, and by streets with barracks on either side. Small Newgate-like looking buildings, at the doors of which you may see the sergeant's ladies conversing, or at the open windows of the officers' quarters, Ensign Phipps lying on his sofa and smoking his cigar, or Lieutenant Simpson practicing the flute, to while away the weary hours of garrison dullness. I was surprised not to find more persons in the garrison library, where is a magnificent reading room, and an admirable collection of books. In spite of the scanty herbage, and the dust on the trees, the Alameda is a beautiful walk, of which the vegetation has been as laboriously cared for as the tremendous fortifications which flank it on either side. The vast rock rises on one side with its interminable works of defense, and Gibraltar Bay is shining on the other, out on which from the terraces immense cannon are perpetually looking, surrounded by plantations of cannonballs and beds of bombshells, sufficient, one would think, to blow away the whole peninsula. The horticultural and military mixture is indeed very queer. Here and there temples, rustic summer seats, and sea have been erected in the garden, but you are sure to see a great squat mortar look up from among the flower pots. And amidst the aloes and geraniums sprouts the green petticoat and scarlet coat of a Highlander. Fatigue parties are seen winding up the hill, and busy about the endless cannonball plantations. Awkward squads are drilling in the open spaces. Sentries marching everywhere, and this is a caution to artists, I am told have orders to run any man through who is discovered making a sketch of the place. It is always beautiful, especially at evening, when the people are sauntering along the walks, and the moon is shining on the waters of the bay, and the hills and twinkling white houses of the opposite shore. Then the place becomes quite romantic. It is too dark to see the dust on the dried leaves. The cannonballs do not intrude too much, but have subsided into the shade. The awkward squads are in bed. Even the loungers are gone, the fan-flirting Spanish ladies, the sallow black-eyed children, and the trim white-jacketed dandies. A fife is heard from some craft at roost on the quiet waters somewhere, or a faint cheer from yonder black steamer at the mole, which is about to set out on some night expedition. You forget that the town is at all like Wapping, and deliver yourself up entirely to romance. The sentries look noble pacing there, silent in the moonlight, and Sandy's voice is quite musical as he challenges with a "Who goes there?" All's Well is very pleasant, when sung decently in tune, and inspires noble and poetic ideas of duty, courage, and danger. But when you hear it shouted all the night through, accompanied by a clapping of muskets in a time of profound peace, the sentinel's cry becomes no more romantic to the hearer than it is to the sandy Connaught man, or the bare-legged Highlander who delivers it. It is best to read about wars comfortably in Harry Lorrequer or Scott's novels, in which knights shout their war cries, and jovial Irish bayoneteers hurrah, without depriving you of any blessed rest. Men of a different way of thinking, however, can suit themselves perfectly at Gibraltar, where there is marching and counter-marching, challenging, and relieving guard all the night through. And not here in Commercial Square alone, but all over the huge rock in the darkness, all through the mysterious zigzags, and round the dark cannonball pyramids, and along the vast rock galleries, and up to the topmost flagstaff, where the sentry can look out over two seas. Poor fellows are marching and clapping muskets, and crying all's well, dressed in cap and feather, in place of honest nightcaps best befitting the decent hours of sleep. All these martial noises three of us heard to the utmost advantage, lying on iron bedsteads at the time in a cracked old room on the ground floor, the open windows of which looked into the square. No spot could be more favorably selected for watching the humors of a garrison town by night. About midnight, the door hard by us was visited by a party of young officers, who, having had quite as much drink as was good for them, were naturally inclined for more. And when we remonstrated through the windows, one of them in a young tipsy voice asked after our mothers, and finally reeled away. How charming is the conversation of high-spirited youth! I don't know whether the guard got hold of them. But certainly if a civilian had been hiccuping through the streets at that hour, he would have been carried off to the guardhouse, and left to the mercy of the mosquitoes there, and had up before the governor in the morning. The young man in the coffee room tells me he goes to sleep every night with the keys of Gibraltar under his pillow. It is an awful image, and somehow completes the notion of the slumbering fortress. Fancy Sir Robert Wilson, his nose just visible over the sheets, his nightcap and the huge key, you see the very identical one in Reynolds's portrait of Lord Heathfield, peeping out from under the bolster. If I entertain you with accounts of inns and nightcaps, it is because I am more familiar with these subjects than with history and fortifications. As far as I can understand the former, Gibraltar is the great British depot for smuggling goods into the peninsula. You see vessels lying in the harbor, and are told in so many words they are smugglers. All those smart Spaniards with cigar and mantles are smugglers, and run tobaccos and cotton into Catalonia. All the respected merchants of the place are smugglers. The other day a Spanish revenue vessel was shot to death under the thundering great guns of the fort, for neglecting to bring to, but it so happened that it was in chase of a smuggler. In this little corner of her dominions, Britain proclaims war to custom houses, and protection to free trade. Perhaps ere a very long day, England may be acting that part towards the world, which Gibraltar performs towards Spain now. And the last war in which we shall ever engage may be a custom house war. For once establish railroads and abolish preventive duties through Europe, and what is there left to fight for? It will matter very little then under what flag people live, and foreign ministers and ambassadors may enjoy a dignified sinecure. The army will rise to the rank of peaceful constables, not having any more use for their bayonets than those worthy people have for their weapons now who accompany the law at assizes under the name of javelin men. The apparatus of bombs and 84-pounders may disappear from the Alameda, and the crops of cannonballs which now grow there may give place to other plants more pleasant to the eye. And the great key of Gibraltar may be left in the gate for anybody to turn at will, and Sir Robert Wilson may sleep in quiet. I am afraid I thought it was rather a release, when, having made up our minds to examine the rock in detail, and view the magnificent excavations and galleries, the admiration of all military men, and the terror of any enemies who may attack the fortress, we received orders to embark forthwith in the Agus, which was to early us to Malta and Constantinople. So we took leave of this famous rock, this great blunderbuss which we seized out of the hands of the natural owners 140 years ago, and which we have kept ever since tremendously loaded and cleaned and ready for use. To seize and have it is doubtless a gallant thing. It is like one of those tests of courage which one reads of in the chivalrous romances, when, for instance, Sir Ewan of Bordeaux is called upon to prove his knighthood by going to Babylon and pulling out the Sultan's beard and front teeth in the midst of his court there. But, after all, justice must confess it was rather hard on the poor Sultan. If we had the Spaniards established at Land's End, with impregnable Spanish fortifications on St. Michael's Mount, we should perhaps come to the same conclusion. Meanwhile, let us hope, during this long period of deprivation, the Sultan of Spain is reconciled to the loss of his front teeth and bristling whiskers. Let us even try to think that he is better without them. At all events, right or wrong, whatever may be our title to the property, there is no Englishman but must think with pride of the manner in which his countrymen have kept it, and of the courage, endurance, and sense of duty with which stout old Elliot and his companions resisted Crillon and the Spanish battering ships and his 50,000 men. There seems to be something more noble in the success of a gallant resistance than of an attack, however brave. After failing in his attack on the fort, the French general visited the English commander who had foiled him, and parted from him, and his garrison in perfect politeness and good humor. The English troops, Drinkwater says, gave him thundering cheers as he went away, and the French in return complimented us on our gallantry, and lauded the humanity of our people. If we are to go on murdering each other in the old-fashioned way, what a pity it is that our battles cannot end in the old-fashioned way too. One of our fellow travelers, who had written a book, and had suffered considerably from seasickness during our passage along the coasts of France and Spain, consoled us all by saying that the very minute we got into the Mediterranean we might consider ourselves entirely free from illness. And, in fact, that it was unheard of in the inland sea. Even in the Bay of Gibraltar the water looked bluer than anything I have ever seen except Miss Smith's eyes. I thought, somehow, the delicious faultless azure never could look angry just like the eyes before alluded to, and under this assurance we passed the strait, and began coasting the African shore calmly, and without the least apprehension, as if we were as much used to the tempest as Mr. T.P. Cook. But when, in spite of the promise of the man who had written the book, we found ourselves worse than in the worst part of the Bay of Biscay, or off the storm-lashed rocks of Finisterre, we set down the author in question as a gross impostor, and had a mind to quarrel with him for leading us into this cruel error. The most provoking part of the matter, too, was that the sky was deliciously clear and cloudless, the air balmy, the sea so insultingly blue, that it seemed as if we had no right to be ill at all, and that the innumerable little waves that frisked round about our keel were enjoying an anarithmon gelasma. This is one of my four Greek quotations. Depend on it, I will manage to introduce the other three before the tour is done. Seem to be enjoying, I say, the above-named Greek quotation at our expense. Here is the dismal log of Wednesday, 4th of September. LL attempts at dining very fruitless. Basins in requisition. Wind hard ahead. K. Diable Alice G. Fair Dan Set Gallier? Writing or thinking impossible. So read letters from the Aegean. Apostrophe these brief words give, I think, a complete idea of wretchedness, despair, remorse, and prostration of soul and body. 2 days previously we passed the forts, and moles and yellow buildings of Algiers, rising very stately from the sea, and skirted by gloomy purple lines of African shore, with fires smoking in the mountains, and lonely settlements here and there. On the 5th, to the inexpressible joy of all, we reached Valletta, the entrance to the harbor of which is one of the most stately and agreeable scenes ever admired by seasick traveler. The small basin was busy with 100 ships, from the huge guard ship, which lies there a city in itself, merchantmen loading and crews cheering, under all the flags of the world flaunting in the sunshine, a half score of busy black steamers perpetually coming and going, coaling, and painting, and puffing and hissing in, and out of harbor, slim men of war's barges shooting to and fro, with long shining oars flashing like wings over the water. Hundreds of painted town boats, with high heads and white awnings, down to the little tubs in which some naked, tawny young beggars came paddling up to the steamer, entreating us to let them dive for halfpence. Round this busy blue water rise rocks, blazing in sunshine, and covered with every imaginable device of fortification. To the right, St. Elmo, with flag and lighthouse. And opposite, the military hospital, looking like a palace. And all round, the houses of the city, for its size the handsomest and most stately in the world. Nor does it disappoint you on a closer inspection, as many a foreign town does. The streets are thronged with a lively, comfortable-looking population. The poor seem to inhabit handsome stone palaces, with balconies and projecting windows of heavy carved stone. The lights and shadows, the cries and stenches, the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.